another Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, founder of the UK charity Yes to Life and host for the show, which focuses on integrative medicine for cancer, or integrative oncology. One of the things that marks out many of the approaches that integrative medicine brings to the table is that within the confines of conventional cancer theory, they don't make that much sense. However, there is a theory of cancer within which they do start to make a lot of sense, so unravelling these competing theories could be an important exercise. Today, I'm looking into this with someone who's put a massive amount of thought into this area. Dr. Zandria Williams is a scientist and a naturopath, amongst other things, and is joining me today to dig into the territory of cancer theory and its relevance to treatment and outcomes. I'm speaking to Dr. Williams over Skype at her home in London. Hi, Zandria. Lovely to have a chance to talk to you again.
Thank you. Nice to be back with you.
Okay, so academics are obsessed with theories about the way things work, and cancer's no exception. All of this can seem like a bit of a game to the rest of us, and it's tempting to ask, well, does it all really matter? If you've got cancer, why should we care about how and why it developed?
Well, it always seemed to me, if you're trying to fix something, you need to figure out why it went wrong. You don't fix a noise in the car, you worry about what caused the noise and how you can prevent that noise recurring. Mm-hmm. In cancer, we seem to just say, oh, well, there is a tumour, so now we will throw everything at it that we can in the hope of destroying it. And there is no medical coherent theory as to what causes and leads to cancer. Once we find that, or once they come to understand that, then we can move forward mightily in prevention and in helping people get over it.
Right, so this is important stuff.
Very important.
Yeah. Okay, well, so could we start with a summary of the currently accepted theory of cancer, the one that our oncologists have been taught at their medical school? It's called the somatic mutation theory. When did this first put in an appearance?
Literally about 1914. Until then, I don't know that anything was formulated. One report I came across was that in 1914, somebody whose name I've forgotten, I was looking for it just now thinking you might ask this, but he of his own statement had said, you know, he's not really a doctor or anything else, but he just thought that cancer must be caused by genetic mutations. Now, theories are one thing, it's really a hypothesis of cancer. The genetic somatic mutation theory was actually formulated apparently in him by 1914, and then it came into being established and immediately accepted for some reason. It's never actually been tested and proven until about a decade ago when it was found to be wrong.
Right. Interesting. So how was it found to be wrong?
Well, there was great excitement when the human genome was worked out, a decade or two ago, and the assumption then being that if you understood the genetics of a disease, you'd be a long step towards solving it, and that hasn't actually worked out to be the case. The next excitement was, okay, we can look at tumours, we can work out the genetic makeup of tumours, because we are convinced, our hypothesis unproven, is that it's caused by genetic mutations, so let's look for them. The expectation in that theory is that the development of the tumour would be linear. You would have one cell going wrong, and they have no idea in their theory how it's gone wrong precisely and what's happened, and that the daughter cells would be similar, and the granddaughter cells and the great-granddaughter cells and so forth. It's always female cells that get carried on.
Right.
And so when they looked into that and wrote up the results, they found, as Professor Thornton said in the talk I was at the Royal Society of Medicine here in London, their theory was wrong. Absolutely wrong, but as he said, since we have no other theory, and medicine doesn't, but the metabolic mitochondrial theory does, since we have no other theory, we go on using it.
Right.
Now, to me, as a scientist, you know, my degrees are all in chemistry, biochemistry. Sitting there listening to this, the logic of that is appalling. Mm. If a theory is wrong and you still work with it, you're not going to get useful answers. What they found was that maybe 500,000 different genetic mutations were present in the tumour, or hundreds of thousands of different ones. That's totally outside the accepted theory, the medical theory, the somatic mutation theory. They even found some tumours that had none of the genetic mutations.
Right.
So it's a useless theory, but right. They keep sticking to it.
Right. That's interesting, isn't it? There are none at all. Yeah. I mean, that really
very interesting.
Pulls the rug, yes. Doesn't it? Yeah. Okay, so maybe just you want to give us the arc that this the development of this theory has followed. I mean, you gave us the beginning. You gave us, if you like, the end of the theory. It should have ended then. What happened in between in terms of the development of the theory and the understanding of cancer?
Well, that theory sort of lived on until a decade or so ago, when they found it, you know, some people at least paid attention to the fact that this wasn't explaining what was going on.
Hmm.
And so they looked then, and we had various theories called, you know, the TOF theory, the tissue organization field theory, a clonal theory. We thought it was due to cancer stem cells, which I might come back to. And one of the theories said, well, the problem is with the cells. And then another theory said that the problem is with the architecture of the tissue that stops holding cells in check. And the normal state for cells is to multiply out of it, and your tissue controls it. Another theory says the normal behavior of cells is to stay in control. And then we had about four or five different reports of genetic instability concept. It was very much like they couldn't get to the core of the cause of cancer, and other people have written along these lines. So they become more and more focused on discussing and describing the superficial surroundings, like describing a walk up to Mount Everest without ever getting anywhere near its top.
Right.
And the more they focus on these sort of peripherals, the less likely we are to get to an understanding of what actually caused it.
Right. And could you just relate the approach to treatment to the theory? Because, of course, the two are interlinked, and one's supposed to be driving the other. So
within the medical concept.
Yes. How exactly were these two, the treatments that were developed, linked to the theory?
Well, I don't think they were. Because right. If you say it's genetic, then people have genes. And you get well-respected universities. MD Anderson, for instance, in Texas, one of their papers, they say getting cancer is just bad luck.
Yes.
It doesn't help you do anything. And all it does is make people feel helpless and maybe guilty. And it doesn't work. The way cancer therapy has developed was really from, in the late 1800s, there was a brilliant surgeon who was convinced he could cut cancer out. And without anesthetic and without antibiotics, he subjected a whole lot of different women, of course. First, he thought he could cut out the lump. Then he thought he had to cut out the lump and the lymph nodes in the armpit.
Yeah.
Then he decided he had to cut out the breast. Then that didn't work, so he cut out the ribs, believe it or not. And he cut out the clavicle, the neck bone, and he cut out the shoulder blade. And they still developed, and cancer went on. And he was still convinced you could cut it out. Demonstrably, you can't. Cancer is a systemic disease. So then we had the Marie Curie and the Rutherford developing, understanding and researching with radioactive compounds, particularly uranium. They then realized or learned that radiation killed tumor cells. So they started setting up hospital treatment plans with radiation.
Yes.
Not yet realizing that radiation killed healthy cells just as well. And it rested there until the Second World War. Briefly in the First World War, there was a suspicion that mustard gas was a bit harmful, but that didn't come to anything. Second World War, mustard gas was realized to destroy cancer cells or some cells, and that develops into the more thorough treatment for cancer. However, of course, you know, it does a lot of harm as well as killing off cancer cells, kills off other cells. So then it's more or less a case, if one really looks at it, of saying, let's try this chemical, throw it at cancers and see what works. Let's try that one. I was at a really interesting talk as a biochemist, a really interesting talk at the Royal Institute of Chemistry here, which I belong to.
Yes.
This chap was talking about how they evolved or explored or developed new chemotherapy drugs. Oh, well, that'll be fun. Went along, and it was brilliant. There were huge complex molecules on the screen, and he said, we took this bit out here, we added a longer chain there, we removed this there, we did that. And then we tested to see whether we got better results or less good results. And I said, well, how did you ask him, how did you test if the result was, you know, if you were killing the cancer cells more effectively or not? Oh, well, he said, we measured the size of a tumour.
Right.
And I said, wait a minute, you do know that the cancer cells are only a small proportion of the tumour cells. Sometimes there's a lot, sometimes there's little. And that it's often easier to kill off the healthy cells than the cancer cells. Oh, no, he said, I didn't know that. So I said to him, I know. I said to him in the discussion afterwards when we got together, I said, what are you going to do now that you know your method of measuring the efficacy of your compounds is unsound? Oh, he said, we're getting good grant money. I've got a good research team. We're publishing lots of papers on the basis of our results. I think we'll just keep doing what we're doing.
Brilliant.
And I was appalled. It's useless.
Yeah.
Another big conference like that, a whole weekend on mitochondrial dysfunction and cancer, allegedly. It was all on mitochondrial function. It was brilliant biochemistry, but there was nothing about patients in it at all. And I said to one chap who had come over from Budapest, although he was British, an oncologist, and I said, what about the patient? Oh, he said, patients, they just get in the way. We're just doing research. It's all being done on charity and grant money.
It's very removed from the real world of people suffering from cancer, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's always struck me as rather remarkable, yes, that something which can be very sophisticated in its workings out in the first place can then rely on something as kind of basic as getting a measuring tape out and measuring a tumour.
It's not even sophisticated in the first place. It was a hypothesis out of thin air that said it was a genetic disease. And that was then assumed.
Yes.
Not proven ever, assumed.
Right.
And now it's been disproven.
Okay, so this may be a little bit of a side turning, but I just wanted to go into the fact that along the way, one of the most important developments in the cancer research was when the hallmarks of cancer were defined. So I'm just interested to hear from you, what are the hallmarks and are there any dispute about them?
Well, the hallmarks, that's Weinberg and Hanneman, I think his name is, not the homeopath, or Hanneman.
No.
They listed 6 hallmarks. They are descriptions of something they can see. They don't give you any characteristic of things that are unique to cancer. I mean, they evade the immune system, but then lots of things can get by our immune system. They do not respond to suicide instructions, apoptosis instructions.
Mm-hmm.
They do not, they do multiply unfettered. And they started off with 6 of these. The 6th one was they metastasize.
Yes.
And really, it is only the fact that cancer cells can metastasize and spread that is the lethal part. And then at further discussions within the various committees and, you know, groups, they've added, I think, 5 more now, which describe other aspects of it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But it's all descriptive.
Yes.
It doesn't give you anything to do to help you resolve the problem or prevent the problem.
Right. Okay, but anyway, these are not disputed then. They're just observations which everybody agrees
about. Well, they're descriptions. Yeah. If you say that the mountain, you know, Mount Everest has rifts and valleys and, well, it does have valleys and whatever, whatever, but it hasn't explained what caused Mount Everest.
Right. And the point you were making at the beginning there is that out of the six initial ones, if you took away the last one, number six, you could be describing a benign tumour.
Yes, benign is a bit of a misleading word. A benign tumour in the brain can grow so large that it destroys your brain.
Right.
But by and large, benign tumours, well, they're localised.
Yes.
They might get bigger. You might get a larger and larger growth on your abdomen, well, outside of your arm or somewhere, but it wouldn't interfere in any major way, unless it got huge, with your life.
Yeah.
But once the cells start breaking out of their capsule, if you like, then they're really dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for that. So clearly a lot of the treatments used today in mainstream do have an effect, and in some cases they do work, but they're also plagued by shortcomings. Could you sum up the general shortcomings that affect conventional cancer treatments?
Well, when you say they seem to have effect, there were figures I was quoting to the Advanced Cancer Care course that I was running on Sunday, which is finished now, it was the last one. We looked at the incidence of cancer and the deaths from cancer in America for 7 years up to about 1918. I don't have the figures in front of me, but there was a steady rise in incidence and deaths of about 4%.
Right. Yeah. Not doing anything for prevention.
You know, there's the biggest statistics can show all sorts of things. I've had one close relative and one by marriage dying with cancer. And their death certificate went down, certainly one of them went down as pneumonia and one, I think, went down as heart or something like that. They both had cancer, but they didn't go down as their deaths. And it's often the consequence of serious illness and cancer and the failure of your cells and mitochondria that ultimately leads to the death.
Right.
But the original cause is not put down as cancer. You can do all sorts of things with statistics.
Yes.
We largely are losing the war on cancer that Nixon started in the 1970s. There's no real debate about that amongst true research and all in the medical field. You know, I'm a scientist. I need the proper evidence and statistics and numbers, and they are there.
Yeah. But so, well, yes, I completely can see that, the approach that we're taking is doing nothing to stop the increase in cancer incidence, and therefore, the rates of death are also going up along with it. But obviously some people get treated by conventional treatment and they do come out the other side and live for many years. So it's having some effect, and of course some of the effects are measurable even if they're just tumour size. So given that, there is this kind of generalised thing where there are shortcomings such as, say, treatment resistance, which I think there isn't a conventional treatment, as far as I know, that doesn't suffer from treatment resistance.
Well, going back to that talk by Dr. Swanson, the RSM, he started that by saying it is inevitable that people will become resistant to chemotherapy. And when, at the end of his talk, and nobody downsayed his statement that we use this theory in spite of the fact that we know it's wrong, some of them kind of let that drift by them. And one woman said, well, you know, what about chemotherapy? Is that any help? And he said, no, we know that chemotherapy makes cancer cells more resistant to treatment because cancer cells adapt very quickly to what's going on in the body generally.
Mm.
And somebody else said, well, what about radiation there? They're all desperate to find an answer within their system.
Yes.
And he said, no, radiation breaks up the DNA and you get all sorts of unstructured chromosomes floating around and getting built into new DNA. He said it's going to make it more likely. And you get, you know, people think if you live 5 years, you're cured. And even if you die a week later, you go down as a cured from cancer.
Yes.
But many people you know, they will have, let's say, radiation on a breast tumour and then 12 years later get cancer of the same lung under that spot. But that's not associated in the reports.
Right.
All chemotherapy is toxic. You get people who come in and say, well, we have, you know, I have this fuzzy brain, what can you do? And I said, well, if it's caused by chemotherapy, not much.
Mm.
We can help and do some things, but, you know, the damage is there. The damage from on their soles of their hands and feet start falling off. You're dealing with very toxic poisons.
Yes, right.
Now, some people will recover anyway. Some people's immune system will do really, really well. Some people will struggle no matter how good, and following our alternative theory and protocols will still not make it, because the human body is unique and the motion and the psyche are unique and they play a role too. But you look at the overall picture, cancer was about 6% of a chance of getting cancer 100 years ago, and now your chance is very close to 50%.
Mm.
I ran the course here with you know, say a dozen or more people in it. We do the test that can, it's a blood and urine test, we don't invade the body. It can pick up the signs of the start of the cancer process. No tumour yet, just the process leading to a tumour.
Mm-hmm.
We can do that test, and I found that 3 out of a class of 12 actually were heading for cancer, and they've now instigated prevention strategies early, so their chances are very good.
Hmm, interesting. All right, well, that's another whole territory, prevention, of course. So, not something that's focused on too much by mainstream medicine, unfortunately. It's probably the most important topic of our time in terms of health.
Well, funnily enough, there was a published report about the doctors and even doctors associated with cancer peripherally should be encouraged to support people to improve their lifestyle. Mm. Now, unfortunately, that simply means stop smoking and lose weight.
Yes.
But some of them would go a little further. Mostly, you go into the oncology clinics and you're fed sugar and cakes and biscuits and bundle cookies, which is going in the wrong direction. But of the whole cancer field, many of them said, well, we do a bit, but among the oncologists themselves, according to this report, only 26.7% bothered to tell their clients to improve their lifestyle. And their reasons were, well, they weren't quite sure what to say, they didn't have time, and they didn't want to worry or overburden their clients or patients.
Mm.
And those aren't good enough reasons, but it's the oncologists particularly that didn't.
Yes.
Do anything about changing lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. All right, interesting figures. All right, can we just step back a second to something you've already mentioned? I just wanted to go into the subject a little bit more. You mentioned cancer stem cells. Well, these, are they a matter of theory or fact, and how important are they in the overall scheme of things?
Well, they come back to the work. Can I go into this history a little bit?
Sure.
Beard, Dr. Beard in 1904, was the first one to come up with a useful information about cancer. He was an embryologist, very well-respected embryologist. He trained and lectured in Germany and Edinburgh as well as in England. And he found that the embryo, 55 days old, started secreting pancreas extract. And he thought that's absurd because mother's doing all the work. The embryo doesn't need that.
Right.
Then he realized that pancreas extract stopped the rapid growth rate that goes on for the first couple of months and slowed it down to the end. Then he thought, in that case, because he could see that the cancer tissue and placental tissue were identical. He didn't say similar or the same. He said they're identical.
Right.
And he started injecting people with pancreatic enzymes. He thought in those days you had to inject. You don't. Enzymes like this you can easily take by mouth and they survive the gut. And he started injecting people with cancer given that. I don't say he was perfect. He was experimenting with what he was doing, but he was getting much, you know, definite improvement by doing that. And then the next person who took over from him after he died, he had 192 cases of good results until a ruling was passed that you weren't allowed to inject pancreas into the body, and then it had to stop.
Hmm.
Now, that's the beginning of what we can do. Now, Beard looked at all of this, and he talked about rogue trophoblastic cells, but essentially they were stem cells. They were, it was just a different name. And these are the cells that are around in your body, so that if they're in your on your backside and you cut your backside open on a bad accident, the local stem cells start producing replacement cells.
Right.
And it's been suggested that these are the more virulent ones. It's been suggested that they, even if you kill off the cancer, operate and move it all surgically, and if the stem cells are left and you've done nothing to change your lifestyle or improve whatever triggered the cancer in the first place, they're the ones, they're there, they're waiting, and they can start it up again.
Right.
It is suggested.
Okay. So stem cells are in a different league to general cancer cells, cancer stem cells, should I say. And so they have this capability to really, they would be the ones that would set up camp. If you had a metastasis, for example, they would be the ones that start a whole new process somewhere else.
Well, could be, but if we, you know, you've got to get round to the, if I may, the mitochondrial metabolic approach to cancer, and start understanding what's going on in cells that first turn cancerous.
Okay.
And that, and a lot of your listeners will have read this. This is a lot to do with Otto Warburg.
Right.
He has a Nobel Prize for biochemistry. He's not a slouch.
Right.
Apparently he was even getting a second one, but Hitler wouldn't have him accept it. And he was talking until about the late 1960s at the conferences. He understood that cancer was the result of the mitochondria, the powerhouses they get called in your cells. But that's misleading, because the thousands or so little mitochondrial organisms inside one of your cells isn't just a powerhouse. It doesn't just release energy from fat, proteins, and carbohydrates. It has a lot to do with the enzymes and proteins that are your protective proteins. P53 is one of the best known. BRCA2 or BRCA1 is another one. BRCA1's not bad. It's only when it's mutated. BRCA1 is arguably your second most protective gene. And when these are damaged, your mitochondria makes other or triggers other genetic changes, P21 and more. And the weakened mitochondria then, instead of metabolizing glucose smoothly, ferments it. It starts to ferment in the cell. And if you land up with about 30% reduction, 33%, a third reduction, in the oxygen available to the mitochondria, then they start to ferment. Then the glucose forms a number of compounds that actually stimulate mitosis, cellular replication. And you're headed for cancer.
Right. So you're saying
that hasn't been proven. You get people like Thomas Seyfried, and currently very outspoken, wrote a wonderful book earlier this century, taking Warburg's ideas. I mean, when he put his theory forward, you in the 1920s, you barely knew what the mitochondria did.
Right.
And you didn't have the Krebs cycle or the citric acid cycle or anything else that some of the listeners were. We didn't know what they did. He was absolutely brilliant in the way he forecast this. And testing and testing and testing it. His theory has been moved a little bit this way and that as we've learned more. That's why that happens. We've learned new things that stop mitochondrial function. I'm researching one at the moment that I'm very excited about, but it needs more thinking on my part. When the mitochondria stops working properly, everything else follows from there. Think about this.
Mm-hmm.
You have approximately 1,000 mitochondria in the cell.
Okay.
You have trillions of cells in your body. A trillion times 1,000 is a huge number.
Mm.
And if you even just say you've got 1,000 mitochondria in a cell, and each of them, let's say, have a 500,000 different gene or whatever it is, and they all start mutating, you're going to land up with a tumor with as many mutations. And that's what they found when they looked at the genome where we came back in. 500,000 genetic changes in a tumour cell, it's not an excessive number for what you can readily predict from the biochemistry of the metabolic mitochondrial approach to cancer.
Right. Okay. So what we're looking at now is this parallel world, if you like, of the metabolic theory of cancer, the other major theory that's around about cancer, which, yeah, you say it's got a long history. It's not new by any means, but it's certainly not...
It's got a longer history than, you know, it's 1904 was Beard, 1914 was postulate.
Okay. Yeah, but it's not really had the attention that the somatic theory's had. It's largely been accepted as, well, yes, that does happen, but it's not that important. And it's been put to one side, if you like, in favour of putting all the attention on gene theory.
It's had a thread all the time going through. A number of people in Europe followed on from Beard's work. A number of people have followed on from Warburg's work. We come up to, I don't know, let's say about 1940s, 50s, and we have a number of people who get lambasted by the medical profession, like, a recent doctor, Nick Gonzalez,
yes,
with several people between there, we needn't go into it all, doing brilliant work, and yet you read him up in Wikipedia and he's written up as a charlatan. He was an exceptionally good doctor and he got very good results and he struggled very hard to get them accepted. I think one of the problems is that you can make a lot of money and a lot of professional advancement with chemotherapy, radiation therapy, high technical, this, that and the other. You can't make that sort of money telling people to eat less sugar, reduce their starch intake, increase their vegetables, get oxygen into their cells, get rid of the toxins. We have something like 95,000 man-made chemicals pumped into our world now. Hard not to think that nearly all of them will be toxic at some level because they're all totally foreign to the body and largely made out of, you know, coal and oil, maybe oil largely, derivatives. It's much more easy to make a financial success and a career out of a drug approach to cancer than a change your lifestyle and restore homeostasis approach. But in the end, it's the only one that's going to work. There was a report I came across, I'd need to look back to check it for sure, but feel free to do that, that WHO was predicting in 2030 that around two-thirds of people would get cancer in their lifestyle. And then it becomes a question of, okay, here you go, you're born now. I wonder how long it'll be before you get cancer.
Yeah.
Not I wonder how long it'll be before your life ends because of natural causes.
Right.
It's terrifying. And it's ethically, morally, it's abysmal.
Right. Completely agree. So, interesting, what you've done is you've associated the theory, the metabolic theory, with the likely ways of tackling cancer there, and you've used the word lifestyle. So these are naturally then the kind of approaches that would be built upon the metabolic theory.
Yes. Do you want me to go through that or
yes,
every time?
Please do say
okay,
the reasons why this would happen, this would lead to that sort of approach.
Well, the first thing we try to do is increase the oxygen intake to the cells, and that means increasing the appropriate fatty acids in the cell membranes. And that comes down to the work of a Dr. Budvig in 1940s or thereabouts, who was one of the pioneers of analysing essential oils and their composition and the like. And by combining that with an amino acid so that you blend yogurt with flaxseed oil, you can actually, allegedly, her theory, get more oxygen into the cells. I've had somebody who had a brain tumour protruding from his forehead, large. He was on the, you know, you've got a month or so left to live list, middle-aged man, who's, well, younger, young middle-aged man. And he had no muscle control. His mother fed him. What he liked and would eat was this mixture of yogurt and flaxseed oil blended up with raspberries. And that's about all he had except for some vegetable juices.
Right.
And she fed that to him. And he got to a point where he could not only be sat up, but he could stay sitting up. I have pictures of him in the car, open top car with the strap around him.
Yeah.
They could walk him upstairs to the bathroom. And then when he got an infection and was taken into hospital and they fed him hospital food, he went right back down again. Mm. And that whole cycle was repeated again, once more. That sounds terribly simple, but it's really important. Then we have people get all the possible nutrients, not just things that are labeled vitamins. Lipoic acid is a really important compound in the mitochondria, and the man who discovered and wrote it up initially said he wished he'd called it a vitamin, because people don't put it in all the multivitamins because it's not called a vitamin.
Right.
So there are hundreds of things in a general diet of very mixed plant, mostly plant products that help. And then we stop people taking in toxins. You know, organic food is not perfect, but it's a lot better than the non-organic food, in both avoiding what you don't need, but also giving you things you do need that you don't get from other foods.
Mm.
And then if we have time, of course, with a client, we look at, I will often say, you know, what were you doing 2 years before your diagnosis, or three or something? And you'll very often find people were in a state of stress, not any sort of stress, although a heavy stress can be a problem, but stress of the sort where you feel helpless and hopeless about things you can't change. And a Dr. Frieder, who died in about 2008 or so, aged about 86, when she came out of medical, she suddenly got the idea that cancer was caused by adrenal exhaustion. And she did a lot of work with that. She says herself in her very small publications, because she was mainly practicing doctor, she didn't have the money to do the research. But there is a lot of evidence for the effects of stress, the emotional changes, the hormonal and endocrine changes and everything else, that stress damages you, weakens your immune system, does all sorts of things. So that's, and Warburg even picked that, but that's the next step we do. And then we can say to people, okay, you need the pancreatic extract and you need to be doing SIRA detoxing, so that when you break down the tumours, you're not overwhelmed by the toxins. I was at a talk at a conference, and this chap, an oncologist, was saying this was the protocol we developed, and we were really pleased. It increased lifespan by about 2 months in our terminal patients. He said five patients, as they call them, left the study, the trial, but the rest all made a positive improvement, small one, but he thought that was pretty good. And I thought, why would they leave if it's, you know, it's going so well? So I said to him afterwards, why did they leave? Oh, well, he said, they died, of course.
Right.
So I said, you know, it was a bit of a euphemism.
Yes.
I said, what did they die from? He said, oh, TLS. And at this stage, many years ago in my career in this field, which has been the last 20 years, when I specialised in cancer support, I hadn't come across TLS whatsoever. Oh, that's tumour lysis syndrome. He probably thought I was an idiot by then, which means tumour lysis or breakdown syndrome. In other words, they had died from the results of breaking down tumour cells, in his view.
Mm.
And I said, oh, good heavens, we don't get that. I said, when we have people doing what we know breaks tumour cells down, and we know the pancreas does, we've got many examples of that, very practical ones, like you take 10 pancreas capsules and an hour later the breast lump is burning. And 3 months later, 4 months later, something on one woman, it had just about disappeared. And it did in the end disappear. I said, oh, we do a very thorough detox that makes sure not only that they don't die, but that when they come out and come home feeling wretched after chemotherapy, if they do this detox protocol, which needs to be explained, but it's not difficult to do, it makes you feel wonderful and is completely painless and harmless, then not only do they get rid of the immediate aftermath effects of the chemotherapy, but they get to feel livelier, healthier, more alert, and they don't die.
Mm.
Oh, no, he said, no, we don't do things like that.
No.
And that was the end of it.
Mm.
Okay, well, you've outlined the ways there in which a very different approach to treatment actually results from looking at cancer in this different way as a metabolic problem. So look, we've not got a lot of time left, but I wanted to ask you, you've got a bit of a reputation for your drive and enthusiasm, despite the fact you're at a time of life where many people are planning their next cruise or choosing a retirement home.
I'd be bored.
Characteristically, I think you've got some news of some new schemes you're getting underway in your work. Would you like to tell us about them?
Yes, love to. I've been running seminars and lecturing all my career, 50 years of career. But you can't keep doing it, and you reach a certain number of people, but not a huge number. And what I'm now doing is all the topics, simple and complex, that I've talked about, which of course is a bit of a huge target. I'm videoing them all, or doing a video with them that'll be up on the website permanently. And I've got a friend who's 30 years younger than me who initiated this essentially, and she said, look, I'll be around for 30 years more than you. Well, she will if she gets through a diet like mine. And she will keep it going, seriously. Right. So what I'm doing, like the Advanced Cancer Care course, I'm making it all as a video with the slides up and my talk up. You don't have to keep looking at me, there'll be lots else to look at. And it will then be up. And I'm also doing it with the simple things that I say to clients who say to me, oh, but I didn't understand what you meant by cutting out starch, let's say. All right, I'll make a short video about cutting out starch. And I'm going to set it up like the contents of a book. So as I keep putting them up, ticking them off, this one's up, you can say, oh, good, I'll listen to that one now, or that one relates to what I've been thinking now. My thinking is that people will become members. Right. There'll be general membership, which will be free. We just need to know who we're talking to. And a professional membership, which will be a certain amount a year. And as the students this weekend say, well, gosh, that's a lot cheaper than coming to seminars. Videos will stay up long term, or until my friend quits, or until the information becomes out of date.
Right.
Professional ones will be up there as well, and you can log in and do it and think, well, I think a year ago I saw a video from Dr. Williams, and you can go back because it'll be up there permanent. Well, you know, long term.
Yes.
And this way, it's fabulous. This thing I'm just thinking of at the moment, hey, I bet this is what's really damaging the mitochondria, that we can move this thing forward. I'll make a video of that and stick it up. And then when I get more research in understanding and say, well, I can do that better, so I'll replace it and put the better one up. And when I suddenly think, gosh, you know, pomegranate's got a lot going for it, I can do a short video on pomegranate and put it up. And since I like talking, obviously, I'd rather talk you down. I'm looking forward to doing it. And I've canvassed a lot of people around, and they say, you know, just tell us when it goes up. I've signed up for a new website today, and the chap's going to oversee this whole thing. And I'm starting to record today, and I'm starting to try and get to grips with editing program, Camtasia. I'm told it's the easiest one around, but I'm still struggling with it. And then, because I'm not doing quite so many seminars or more, although I do some, I'm doing a one weekend one in October on the determining and use of the different metabolic types and metabolic needs. But even that in time will almost certainly become a webinar video. So that's my new plan, and I'm so excited about it.
Well, I can tell.
My mind day to night.
Right, so you're going to create, you hope, a vast resource, basically, for people to use ongoingly, which is brilliant. All right, we're going to have to leave it there, Zandria. It's always fascinating to talk to you. Of course, you're, as you say, you love to talk, and you're a mine of information about so many things. So
thank
you very much indeed for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Robin, and thank you for all you're doing with your charity and Yes to Life and the support you give a lot of other people. It's all helping a step forward, and we've got a big, big fight to challenge. But I think more than the fight, we've got a huge, exciting exploration and good results and good discovery. Every new patient that comes in to me, it's not a question, oh dear, another poor person with cancer. It's, ha, somebody else I can really help to turn their life around with get positive results. So it's a super exciting field to work in.
Excellent. All right, thank you. Goodbye, Zandria.
Goodbye, Robin. Nice to talk to you.
I hope that discussion provided food for thought and clarified the relevance and importance of theory to practical decisions and outcomes. Look out on Dr. Williams' website, that's zandriawilliams.co.uk, and Zandria is spelt with an X at the beginning. Look on her website, which I understand will shortly get a complete makeover, for details of the new program she just spoke about. Thanks a lot for listening today. Please join me again next week here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.